This is the Angry GM, and it is now time for the supplemental question and answer portion of our proofread aloud. So this is following the proofread aloud of the article, the top five best and worst things in D&D 3.5, according to Angry, or whatever stupid title I finally put on the article. And now I'm taking Q&As from those who are listening live to the proofread aloud in the Discord chat. I'm not expecting actually a whole lot of questions and answered because this was basically just a bunch of unbridled, unqualified, but still utterly correct and objectively true subjective opinions. Nonetheless, I am open to any questions or comments. However, if you want to add any good or bad things of your own in the Q&A portion, I'm holding you to the same rules. You have to have both a good and a bad, or else you can just wait until you make the comment and then have time to figure out one of each. Okay, so that said, Proselys is commenting, man, this is making me so nostalgic for 3.5, really want to run it again. Yeah, it's great, except for all the stuff that sucks about it. Which, you know, actually kind of the point of doing this. There's a reason I did a best and worst list. It's really easy to look back on a system that you enjoyed and had good memories of. And it's equally as easy to, you know, bash a current thing that you're not enjoying very much, and then you completely forget the other side. So it's actually a very interesting exercise to always look at both the best and the worst that a system has to offer, which is what I was doing. Powerful Demon Queasel asks, how would you improve 3.5's fiddly advancement and prerequisite rules? Mainly I do it by just running core only vanilla D&D 3.5 and running it only for people who don't own the books, and then just pretending things like prestige classes don't exist and then guiding them through feat trees. Because as I said in the article, you don't have to make your character that way. You can choose to, and it'll pay off, but if you're willing to just dump the whole idea of trying to build to the awesome archetypes and just settle for, you know, the D&D characters that exist, you know, your elves and your dwarves and your fighters and your clerics and all of that stuff, you can get along perfectly fine, and you never need to engage with the character planning bullshit. That's why I admitted in the article I was being a little bit hyperbolic, but it was still there. Okay, Nori, could one somehow use the 3.5 Dungeon Master's Guide to run 5e? Absolutely, yes. I mean, obviously all the mechanical stuff does not matter. Like, you can't follow the tables that are in there, you know. But really, all the stuff about terrain and settlement building and everything, you could use it all very effectively in 5e. I would highly recommend it, actually. If you really want to get down into that like game buildy homebrewing stuff, and you really want to do it right, get yourself a copy of the Dungeon Master's Guide. I mean, it's just really interesting to flip through and like, I'm just going to open, where's the, because this is what I loved. Okay. So yeah, I'm going to call out one specific thing that actually was the thing that reminded me how awesome this was to have. So there is, in the adventure building chapter, there's a two-page spread, or maybe a single page on each. There's a spread of, a section on each type of terrain. So if you turn to the terrain type, like let's say I'm looking at the hills terrain, okay? First of all, you get a general description of what hills are like. Then there's actually a couple of different kinds of hills. You can run gentle hills or rugged hills, which is also nice to know. And if you're designing a battle map in those terrains, like a battlefield in those terrains, it actually tells you how much of the map should be taken up by gradual slopes, steep slopes, cliffs, and light undergrowth. And then it tells you what all those things mean. What's a gradual slope? What's a steep slope? How should it affect the game? Then it lists other elements that you might have, like active streams that are 5 to 10 feet wide and usually less than 5 feet deep, or dry stream beds, yada, yada, yada. It talks about stealth, detection, spotting distance, and even gives you a sample encounter table. It doesn't give you, I mean, there are encounter tables by terrain for literally everything also. But it just runs you through all of that for every kind of terrain. Just like that alone just helps a GM picture a world and build scenes in the world. So yes, just for those few chapters on like terrain and world building and settlement building and stuff, absolutely get yourself a copy of the D&D 3.5 Dungeon Master's Guide. Proselis, definitely looking at the flaws, both yours and the ones I remember, to see what I could tweak or fix. Yep. Mostly, I got by the flaws by ignoring them. You just learn. That's the thing, right? As you GM for a long period of time, you eventually learn to patch over the flaws. All that minutia about setting the DCs, like, I don't remember off the top of my head how to honestly set the DC for tracking 7 ogres through a forest that passed there 2 days ago when it rained for 2 hours last night and it was foggy this morning. I had to look up the table, but I roughly would have called that a DC 20 check. Maybe DC 15. And it was a DC 17 check, so either one of those answers would have been right. So as a GM, you just kind of learn to wing it. Anyway, Logic Dragon. Is I take 10 something a player says, and is it supposed to represent the something that their character chooses to do differently in the world as opposed to when you have them roll? I feel like this was asked and answered, and I feel like this was asked and answered in the Discord specifically between you and I, Logic Dragon. So I feel like you're actually trying to reopen a debate that we already kind of had, but I'm going to assume that my memory is faulty because it's been a long, weird weekend, okay? And I'm not feeling at my best. So here's the thing. Yes and no. It was this murky idea that, you know, you could just leap in to taking an action. Like, I'm going to go pick the lock. Or a character can just take a moment, okay? Because, and I'm very careful to say take extra time, because then everybody says, well, then it takes, you know, more than a standard round. It's not like that, okay? There is a difference between jumping in and doing something and taking a moment to go, okay, let me think this shit through. What kind of lock am I looking at here? Where are my tools? Let me lay them out. Let me think through this. Let me just look at the problem. Okay, now I'm ready to go. And then when your hands start to shake, you say, okay, it's okay. There's nothing coming at me right now. Everything is good. Breathe and go. Okay, people are much better, much more functional when they are operating under no stress. Not only that, I mean, that's scientific, okay? Your stress hormones make you worse at doing anything. They do, okay? They also exhaust you. So, but we also have this problem of perceived stress. So the idea was the character could just talk themselves down and say, okay, you know what? There's not actually a monster in the room right now. And if I just take my time and work through this lock, I'm more likely to do it well than if I just jump into it. And the idea was that by taking care and slowing down, you would always end up with an average result. You would take off all the bad results, but you would also take off all the best results. Like, luck became less of a factor. That was the idea. I'm going to calm myself down and not let luck be the biggest factor. I'm going to take the average roll. So in world, that was the logic for what the character could do when a player decided, I take 10. Did you sometimes end up having to do it on actions where that didn't quite make the most sense? Yeah, I'm not going to deny that. There's always a point in any game where things have to be abstracted. Okay, but that's it. It was a choice a player made about whether their character was approaching things and trying to, you know, achieve the best result possible as quickly as possible, or whether the player or the character was just taking it calm and just trying to get through it. Okay. How has the Magic in the World portion of the D&D 3.5 DMG helped your campaigns? Could it be used outside of D&D 3.5? I mean, again, yeah, it's lore. Okay, that said, the lore doesn't work anymore in 3E or in 5E, and 5E is all like, fuck you about the magic lore, isn't it? It doesn't care how spell slots work and what it means. A lot of it is just nice, flavorful description stuff. Like, it's just kind of understanding things, but at the same time, just being able to have pictures of how things work in your head. I mean, here's a really good example. It is very easy to forget in 3.5 that you can hold spell slots open and fill them later. Okay, that is a wizard who wakes up in the morning, studies his spell book, can prepare most of his spells and say, well, I'm not really sure all the challenges I'm going to face. I'm going to hold a few spells open and decide later what to prepare. And then if the wizard can find a quiet 15 minutes or whatever to then sit down and study their spell book, they can fill those slots in the course of play. So, you know, like the party is like, you know, they encounter to negotiate with a race and they don't speak the name and they weren't expecting to speak the language and they weren't expecting to encounter them. The wizard could say, okay, look, if you just give me 15 minutes to go study my spell book, I can drop comprehend languages into this open first level spell slot I've got. And then they, you know, it's like, okay, and, you know, everybody would just stand around awkwardly, you know, chatting amongst themselves in their own languages. And you would have this vague sense that the monsters were making fun of you in, you know, like the people in the nail salon who are always making fun of you in Mandarin or whatever. Not that I go to nail salons and not that I've ever been made fun of in Mandarin Chinese, but there you have it. But anyway, so that's an easy rule to forget until you sort of think through, oh, well, it would make sense that in the world that is a possibility because preparing a spell is actually pre-casting most of the spell and then just holding it a little blob in your like third eye and then releasing it. So yeah, it would make sense that you don't have to do that first thing in the morning. But also understanding that your spell slots are only fresh for, like, you only have the energy for your spell slots first thing in the morning. So once you burn a spell, you can't then put something back in that spell slot because there's also magical energy. You know, it's just stuff like that. But honestly, the more you understand about how your world works, the easier it is to just keep the world in your head and to picture things so that when something weird does come up that you didn't think about, you have an answer that at least makes sense with everything else in the world. How Kaladrev is asking, how does the take 20 rule interact with the idea that a GM has to determine whether a die roll is appropriate? Well, see, now that's kind of exactly the point, isn't it? Okay. When you think of how does the GM determine whether a die roll is appropriate? You're thinking of Angry's excellent, you know, four rules about is it possible to succeed? Is it possible to fail? Is there, you know, you gotta risk, cost, consequences, all that stuff. Okay. In D&D 3.5, the GM only had to make one call, and that is, is it reasonably practical to assume that this action could both succeed and fail? Okay. And when I say reasonably practical, and there is a discussion about this in the rules, the idea of reasonably practical is there a chance that you could choke to death every time you eat a piece of food? Yes. Is that a high enough chance to consider it a reasonably practical, likely all outcome? No, that is why you don't chew on, you know, roll to swallow each piece of food ever. But that's the beginning and the end of what the GM had to determine. This action that the player described, can I envision a world in which it succeeds? Can I envision a world in which it fails? Okay, fine, it's a die roll. And then the player says, well, can I take 20? And then the GM says, well, there's not really serious consequences for failure. And also, there's not really any time pressure. So yeah, as long as you're willing to take 2 minutes on a lockpicking attempt that should only really take you 10 seconds, then yeah, you can take 20. And that just, you know, it takes the judgment out of the GM's responsibility. And that's what I'm complimenting. Okay, these rules mean the GM only needed two conditions for determining whether or not to call for a die roll. And then it let the players decide on what stakes they wanted to have on that die roll, barring situations that constrained them. Like if you're climbing a cliff, you can't take 20 because if you fail by enough, you're going to fall. and that'll lead to damage. So you can't just keep rolling until you make it right. But if you are climbing a cliff, you can take 10, provided there's nothing chasing you up the cliff or attacking you, or the GM doesn't decide something else is making the situation stressful. Like if it's pouring rain, the GM could say, you know what? No, you can't take 10. Then again, if it's pouring rain, you probably don't want to take 10, because if you consult the skills chapter of the player's handbook, you will determine that if the thing you're climbing is slippery, that increases the DC by 5, so you probably don't want to go for an average result at that point. Okay, powerful demon Queasel. Do you like the way 3.5 handles gear, items, and advancement with respect to those things? How has that changed in later editions? Okay, I assume... So is this the whole D&D 3.5 assumes that you must have equipment of certain levels and yada, you know, if you're like a 6th level person, you probably have your first magical weapon, yada, yada, yada. Do I like that shit? I mean, honestly, yes. Yes, I do. I think that's good. Okay. I think it's good if there's prescribed equipment advancement and that it is spelled out in the book. Okay. The fact of the matter is D&D has always sort of done that, but also sort of not. That is, anything prior to 3E, it was not systematic. It was all basically scattershot, hit or miss. They were just making up shit as they went and tweaking things and playing with things because good game design hadn't been invented yet. Okay, 3E was the invention of systematic tabletop role-playing game design. In the mainstream. I'm not going to say there were no games other than D&D doing it, but D&D 3.5 or D&D 3rd edition is the edition that said, what if we actually tried to build a balanced game and spell everything out systematically and make everything work by universal rules? Which is a good approach, and one of the things they did it with was the equipment progression system. You should, period. Like, you need to find equipment that will help enhance your abilities and skills, and the game assumes that you'll do that. The 3.5 also assumes that wizards are periodically making their own scrolls to augment their Vancian spellcasting ability, which is why, as I said before, wizards invented scrolls in the first place. So anyway, 4th edition did basically the same thing. Everybody says, oh, it was really heavy-handed about it. It really wasn't any more heavy-handed than any other edition of D&D. All it did was give players a little bit more control over it. And 5th edition, basically, it says, you know what? Let's just let magic items break the game because we don't want to give a shit about it. And also, we don't have time to figure out the system. Which, by the way, I'm going to say, I'm 90% sure, 95% sure, and this is based somewhat on internal knowledge of Wizards of the Coast things that were going on at the time, which some of which I've talked about before. I'm 90% sure that the main reason there is not a magic item progression and equipment possession built into Dungeons & Dragons is because they ran out of time to build it. I'm also of the opinion that the solution was just to make characters so powerful that if they never got magical items, they still would feel that most of the game was fairly trivial, and I don't think that's a good approach. D&D 5e is basically saying, you know, the game is so safe anyway that if you don't give your players magical items, they're not even going to notice a problem, and it's true. I like how 3.5 handles it. I think 3.5, if anything, it was a little too control freaky. 3.5 was control freaky. Okay, it was a control freak on everything. That's its big thing. That's with the fiddly bits, with everything else. It was control freaky. It wanted to spell out everything in exacting detail. But then it was the first experiment with systematic universal game mechanics and balanced progressions and all of that stuff. It invented game balance. Okay, it's the first edition in which balancing encounters wasn't called an optional rule. Just saying. So anyway, do I like it? Yeah. Could it have been done better? Yeah. You know, probably. But, you know, what are you going to do? You either take it into account or you don't, right? That's it. You either take into account the item progression or you don't. One of the things I did like, by the way, about 3.5 was there were ways to customize your equipment without having to find items in the world. Okay, so for example, you could buy Masterwork gear, which was basically just higher quality weapons and armors, and it filled in that gap between the time where you started adventuring and the time you found you started finding actual magical items. And you know, it gave you smaller bonuses, but that was pretty cool. I think the Masterwork armor was kind of lame, but, and I would have liked to see more done with it. You could also get equipment made of special materials. Everything from like, you're thinking like your silver and your cold iron and stuff, but there were also armor materials. Like you could have, particularly light shields made out of dark wood, certain armors could actually be made out of this magical wood called dark wood, which elves did, and it was good for druids because they couldn't use metal gear. You could get armor and equipment and weapons made out of mithril or made out of adamantine, and those things, they had special rules for it. It was really nice because there was more to it than just, okay, there's gear that you can buy on in the player's handbook, and then there's magical items, and there is nothing in between. And it was really nice that D&D 3.5 did all of that. And now segueing into the next question, it was also nice that D&D 3.5 had a systematic approach to item crafting. And Logic Dragon asks, and I'm getting a 5-minute warning from the producer, so whatever, this is going to have to be the last question, and I'm going to have to answer it as quickly as possible, but what do I think of 3.5 magic item crafting? It was okay. I mean... The thing is, it was gated behind feats, right? So you had to have a feat for every kind of magic item you wanted to create. And that just plays into the whole fiddly prerequisite bullshit that 3.5 really liked to do. Then again, it basically gave wizards... It gave wizards two paths with their bonus feats. You could either become a meta magician, where you could start screwing with your spells and casting them in bonkers ways through meta magic feats, or... You could become an artifice wizard and go the route of making magical items by using your bonus feats to make magic item creation feats. The crafting system was extremely... And the thing is, the magic item crafting system and the crafting rules were actually two completely different things with two completely different sets of mechanics. That is, magic item crafting might actually be more appropriately called enchanting, because you didn't actually have to craft anything to craft a magical item. You just had to meet some prerequisites and spend some money and, you know, sit and fondle the item and do the things. You know, whereas if you wanted to make a bow or a masterwork bow, there was a set of rules where you would buy the materials, you would roll crafting checks, and then, you know, it would take a certain amount of time based on the success of your crafting checks and the materials. You might waste materials if you roll crappy rolls. And I kind of liked all of that, except that you couldn't do it away from the table, but I did like it. And that was to make any normal piece of equipment. If you wanted to make a magical bow, assuming that you already had a bow of masterwork quality, all you had to do was meet the requirements to make the magical bow, pay the money, and spend the time. It was assumed that your spellcaster could do it if they knew how to make magical weapons, if they had the right spells on their spell, in their spell book, and if they could then, you know, and then they spend the item, and bam, now they have a magical bow. You could also be a craftsman that made your own stuff and then enchanted it, and then you have to engage with both sets of rules. I think it all needed some work. Okay, I think it was a very good beginning, and I enjoy using it in my games. It's not like, oh my God, the crafting items are so terrible, I will never ever use them. The biggest problem with magic item crafting, and this is the point I'm going to end on, the biggest problem with magical item crafting is this. The list of items that could be crafted were in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So even if you had a player who could brew potions or make magical weapons or craft wondrous items or craft wands or whatever, they didn't have an easily accessible list of the things they could make and the conditions for making them, which meant very few people made magic items. And with that, I want to thank everybody for hanging out. I'm sorry this is a little bit of a... I'm not sorry this was... I'm babbling now. Let me try again. thanks everyone for hanging out, listening to this proofread aloud of the article, and for sticking around to answer questions and make comments. It has been fun. I am not sorry that this wasn't shortened. I am sorry for my general demeanor and low energy and the fact that I was fumbling a little bit more. But, you know, that's just the thing. Anyway, I will be back. Probably at the end of this week, I'll be recording another proofread aloud for the second part of this because I've been writing the two of them in tandem. And you can find out what the best and worst five thing, or the best five things and the worst five things about D&D 5e are. So, see you then.